Hello everyone, this is Jackie Keith with the Saturday edition of the New York Times for Saturday, August 22nd. And a big thank you to my colleagues for covering me the last couple of weeks while I had a hip replacement. This is a story by Dave Phillips. They once run free through the desert mountains of the West, a multicolored band of 68 wild Mustangs that had never been saddled or corralled. Then the federal government rounded them up with helicopters, as it has with tens of thousands of other Mustangs, in an attempt to control wild population on public lands. The horses were held for years in a feedlot in Idaho while the government tried to find them what is called loving homes. Abruptly this March, the government found a home. Whether it was loving didn't seem to matter. The horses were packed into echoing metal trailers and trucked 1,800 miles east to the pens of a hard livestock trader in Ohio named Brandon Jones, who bought them for $25 each. A day later, two double-decker cattle trucks pulled up at midnight, loaded the Mustangs, and quickly drove off into the night. From there, the Mustangs disappeared. They never appeared at a public auction. The trader won't say where they went. Wild horse advocates suspect the horses were shipped to slaughter. But that's not the government's concern. It got what it wanted, two more trucks of wild horses off its books. It wasn't the first time or the last. In the past year, the government has shipped the trader one truckload of Mustangs after another. And not just him. An examination of government records by the New York Times found that all over the country, the Bureau of Land Management, the agency in charge of protecting wild horses, is quietly selling thousands of horses to buyers like the one in Ohio. Slaughtering wild horses is illegal, but the Bureau's actions create a loophole that enables people to get Mustangs on the cheap and then quickly resell them to be exported alive, processed into cuts of meat, and sold abroad. Livestock inspection records show Mustangs sold by the government soon ended up on trucks bound for slaughter plants in Canada. The U.S. government sales of wild horses were once rare, but started to rise after President Trump took office. In 2024, they more than doubled to 3,700 horses, according to Bureau records. In that time, the Bureau has sent about 500 horses to Mr. Jones. They came from all over the West, the windswept ridges of Cedar Mountains in Utah, the canyons of the Klan Alpine Wilderness in Nevada, the high meadows of Twin Peaks, California, and the carved red rock hoodoos of Adobe Town, Wyoming. In an interview, Mr. Jones said he was able to resell the horses quickly through, though he didn't advertise online or even post a for sale sign at his corral. He would not say where the horses went and denied selling any to slaughter. President Trump has opened a new front in his campaign to intimidate political foes, threatening a prominent liberal think tank with a $5 billion defamation lawsuit over a report concluding that his deployment of the National Guard to cities across the country has had little effect on reducing violent crime. The threats against the think tank, the Center for American Progress, were Mr. Trump's latest effort to use the legal system to punish critics for voicing unflattering facts and opinions generally protected by the First Amendment. And while it is unclear how far any suit the president might ultimately file will get into court, it could force the organization to spend money fighting it off and make even more of a target of his allies and supporters. On Monday, one of Mr. Trump's personal lawyers, Alejandro Brito, wrote a letter to the center warning that he would file the suit if the group did not fully retract the report, which was published on its website on July 13. The letter, viewed by the New York Times, was addressed to the group's president and chief executive, Neera Tanden, a longtime Democrat official who served as a senior advisor to President Joseph R. Biden, Jr., and to several of its board members. Mr. Brito claimed that the report about the National Guard was full of malicious and false statements. He gave Ms. Tandon and members of her board until 5 p.m. on Friday to retract it and apologize to Mr. Trump. Ms. Tandon pushed back, saying in a statement that the center would neither cower nor bend in the face of legal action. She also defended the report, asserting that while its findings may have been inconvenient to the Trump administration, they were grounded in rigorous evidence-based research and analysis. The threatened lawsuits attacked on facts and evidence's basis, she said. A fundamental protection of the First Amendment is to allow for the publication of facts and analysis that is contrary to the arguments and claims of any administration. A lawsuit is a transparent attempt to silence us. Mr. Trump has often lashed out at scholars and commentators for reproaching or critiquing him in the news media, and since winning re-election, he has filed a flurry of lawsuits against news organizations like the BBC and The Times, claiming they defamed him. He has even filed suit against the Des Moines Register, arguing that a poll the paper published before the 2024 election, indicating that he would lose the vote in Iowa, amounted to consumer fraud and election interference. The Times has filed its own suits against the administration, including two seeking increased action for its reporters at the Pentagon. The president has repeatedly claimed that his administration is the most transparent in American history, but he and his aides have used lawsuits and executive actions to go after law firms, universities, and television networks. They have also used criminal tactics such as search warrants and grand jury subpoenas in an effort to pry loose sensitive information from reporters. Now, news analysis from David Pearson from Hong Kong. As Iran's largest trading partner, China would seemingly have much to lose from President Trump's threat this week to impose tremendous economic consequences on nations doing business with Tehran. For decades, China has defied Western sanctions on Iranian oil by buying up to 90% of Tehran's oil exports. China has also supplied Iran with technology and raw materials to build an arsenal of missiles and drones. But Beijing has reasons to feel confident it can withstand Mr. Trump's latest warning, if it is ever fulfilled. The increasingly Chinese analysts see the war in Iran, which the White House seems unable to end on favorable terms, as a sign of America's mounting weakness. This threat reveals how desperate the Trump administration has become on the issue of Iran, said Wu Jingbo, a leading American studies scholar at Fudan University in Shanghai, who advises China's foreign ministry. They issue this threat not because they think it is workable, he said, but because they have no other options to get out of this self-created dilemma. In a social media post on Wednesday, Mr. Trump vowed to inflict an economic D-Day on Iran, as well as to punish countries that provide any type of lifeline to the country. On Thursday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent implied that it was in China's best interest to cooperate. But China may be feeling emboldened as the United States withdraws military assets in the Pacific that were largely meant to protect power in Asia. Most recently, they included moving the aircraft carrier George Washington out of the region to support operations in the Middle East. Lin Xian, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry, said on Friday that China opposed unilateral sanctions and that pressure would not resolve the crisis in Iran. One major reason that pressure may backfire against the United States is that China is equipped to cut the supply of critical minerals to American companies, including makers of U.S. weapons, which have been depleted because of the war. China demonstrated the power of this chokehold when it forced Mr. Trump to pause a blistering trade war last year by cutting off its critical minerals exports. That detente has largely held. The threat of economic consequences now raises questions about the durability of that truce, nearly a month before Mr. Trump is scheduled to host China's top leader Xi Jinping for his first state visit to Washington since 2015. Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi last met in Beijing in May in a summit that China interpreted as highly successful. Mr. Trump did not challenge Mr. Xi on divisive issues like the status of Taiwan, the self-governed island claimed by Beijing, and he was effusive in his praise, calling Mr. Xi a great leader. I doubt either side wants Iran to derail Xi Jinping's upcoming visit to the United States. President Trump has clearly attached considerable importance to his relationship with Xi and to the visit itself, said Wang Xicheng, a foreign policy analyst at the Center for China and Globalization, a research institute in Beijing. Mr. Trump's threat could also just be bluster, Mr. Wang said. There is by now a considerable credibility discount attached to individual statements by President Trump on Iran, Mr. Wang said. One of Harvard University's biggest federal funding stream is down sharply, according to a New York Times analysis of government data. The declines have persisted even after a federal judge forced the Trump administration to reverse drastic cuts to the university last year. The funding from the National Institutes of Health currently lags about 18% behind the average pace of grants during the Biden administration, the analysis shows. Last year, Harvard successfully sued the Trump administration after the government announced it had frozen more than $2.2 billion in 2025 from multiple federal agencies. But unlike then, when Trump officials made a public spectacle out of announcing the cuts, the NIH is mainly delaying, reducing, or rejecting grants requests, often leaving researchers and university leaders in the dark about what is happening. The reduction appears to be the latest front in the Trump administration's on-again-off-again war with Harvard and other elite universities. It is a new, more subtle tactic that is harder to fight in court, but that could be just as damaging if cuts and uncertainty build. The Trump administration has targeted a number of the nation's elite universities, accusing them of tolerating anti-Semitism and pursuing racial diversity in ways that flout the laws, among other criticisms. Harvard, the country's wealthiest university, has been one of the most frequent targets of federal officials. As the Trump administration has pulled multiple levers to try to bring Harvard and other schools to heel, Harvard has often pushed back. It was the first institution to sue the Trump administration, has won in court on a number of occasions, and has not reached a settlement with the federal government as other prominent schools have done. Now, however, the university faces cuts that may be harder to counter. Last September, a judge ruled that the administration had improperly cut off funding to Harvard when it ended all of its grants in 2025. Finding that the government had violated Harvard's First Amendment rights. But in the ruling, the judge suggested that there were lawful means the government could pursue if it wanted to restrict Harvard's money should it choose to. That is what is happening. Through June 30 of this fiscal year, which began October 1, the NIH provided Harvard 309 awards worth a total of $200 million. The amount is down from an average of roughly 440 awards worth $246 million for the same nine-month period in 2021-24, according to the latest data available. Harvard is still one of the largest recipients of NIH funding, though it is far behind the top grantees, such as Johns Hopkins, the University of Michigan, and Yale. Other major research universities have also seen reductions in NIH funding. From Slovyansk, Ukraine. Stay or try to escape. Nina Ivanova, 77, felt the odds of survival were 50-50 either way, and she had nothing left to lose. Russian forces was just over a mile away battering her city, Lyman, in eastern Ukraine, with glide bombs and drones. Her husband was dead after a long illness and her home was destroyed. She was hiding in a basement with her two daughters. Lyman was burning, but civilian and military evacuation teams no longer entered the city, given the danger. The only way out was on foot, 9 miles under drone-filled skies. When Miss Ivanova saw a body eaten by dogs in Lyman, it helped push her to her limit, she said. She and her daughters would take their chances on the road, as countless Ukrainians have done before them, all along the front line. We got up and left, she said. Miss Ivanova and her husband, Boris, lived in Lyman for decades. They raised their children there in a house on Merchurina Street. The city, which had a pre-war population of 20,000, served as a rail hub for the Donbas region. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, seizing the Donbas was a central aim, and that made Lyman a prime target. Russian forces fought their way through dense forests and fields surrounding Lyman and seized the city in May 2022. Ukrainian troops drove them out 5 months later, but Lyman was never fully free of Russian fire. Over time, Moscow's small advances towards the city began to add up, and strikes on Lyman started intensifying again last fall. That's when humanitarian delivery stopped. Miss Ivanova's home was hit in a strike on December 17th. The roof collapsed and the windows were blown out. 2 days later, her living room was smashed in a second strike. Her family, though, was safe. They were sheltering in the basement of a five-story building with neighbors. They slept under three blankets, wearing jackets and hats in below-zero temperatures, and they cooked stockpiled food aid on bricks over an open fire. Mr. Ivanov, 79, who had been bedridden for 8 years, died on January 12th. The Ivanova women buried him in the yard. Things only got worse. One man who was living in the basement died in a strike on March 14th. Another was killed the next day while digging a grave for the first. That left 7 people in the underground shelter. The Ivanovs, as a friend called Tetiana Shmarko, and a family of 3. The Ivanova women stayed on as Russian troops intensified attacks through March and April and into May. They stayed even as their supplies dwindled, even as others took their chances fleeing the city on foot, and even as the mayor implored them to do the same. Then, on May 23rd, Miss Ivanova said they realized that they simply could not sit in that basement any longer, and their patience and nerves had run out. Governor Kathy Hochul had resisted pressure from the left to raise taxes as she ran for re-election this year before agreeing to a compromise, a tax on high-end second homes in New York City. The move would secure desperately needed revenue and deliver a win to her ally, Mayor Zoran Mamdani. But what happened to be a comfortable resolution soon turned into a quagmire, with business leaders feeling vilified by the city introduction of the tax, and some homeowners confused and outraged after being told they might have to pay. Reactions that troubled Miss Hochul. The rollout could have been better, Miss Hochul said in an interview this week, recounting a conversation she had with Mr. Mamdani earlier this summer. Absolutely, I said the rollout has to be cleaned up and fixed. Miss Hochul was concerned about what she saw as a clumsy messaging by Mr. Mamdani as he introduced esoteric tax to New Yorkers. She told the mayor that he needed to be clearer about how the tax would be administered and whom it would affect, according to 2 people familiar with their talks, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. The governor had taken note of how the mayor, a Democrat socialist who campaigned on taxing the rich, was talking about the policy. In a widely seen video, for instance, the mayor had decided to highlight an especially expensive second home owned by a hedge fund manager, Kenneth Griffin. There's a better way to do it, Miss Hochul said, a pro-business moderate. Point to Russian oligarchs and Saudi princes rather than someone who invests in the city, she said. She wasn't the only one to take issue with the execution of an otherwise popular policy, which city officials have estimated will raise hundreds of millions of dollars per year. As criticism mounted in some quarters, Mr. Mamdani and his administration tried to adjust their messaging, But the response did little to quell the blowback, which included a lawsuit that claimed the administration had mishandled the complicated undertaking of instituting a major new tax on a short timeline. The mayor is now being forced to justify the rollout in court, which one judge on Staten Island already suggesting that city officials did not act properly. And in almost gleefully pointing a finger at the wealthy, Mr. Mandani united and emboldened his rivals in their quest to diminish his success. An examination of the rollout reveals an unsteady process propelled by an urgent need for revenue and the mayor's desire to notch a win, hindered by bureaucracy, poor public communication, and a compressed timeline. For Mr. Mandani, it seemed a rare stumble and a reminder to some New Yorkers of his lack of executive experience. We warned from the beginning that the tax would be extremely difficult to administer fairly and accurately, said James Whalen, the president of the Real Estate Board of New York, an influential lobbying group that has criticized Mr. Mandani. He added, the issue is no longer whether the tax is complicated. The issue is whether the city was prepared to implement it. From Washington, the Trump administration has taken a series of extraordinary steps to attack California's position as a national leader in environmental protection, enlisting at least a half dozen federal agencies to undermine the state's effort to pivot away from fossil fuels. The stakes are high because of its market muscle as the world's fourth largest economy. California's environmental regulations have influenced the manufacturers of automobiles and other consumer goods, and its green policies have spread to other states in what's known as the California effect. But President Trump has marshaled the full power of the federal government to clamp down on the state's climate initiatives. He has been vocal in his contempt for Governor Gavin Newsom of California, a Democrat and possible 2028 presidential contender, whom he refers to as Gavin Newsom. Mr. Newsom, a loud and pointed critic of Mr. Trump, pledged soon after the 2024 election to insulate California's environmental policies from a second Trump administration, perhaps making the state an inviting target for a president who has been using government levers to punish perceived enemies. There are almost too many examples to list. Mr. Trump and his Republican allies in Congress have blocked California from setting its own limits on automobile pollution, which federal law has permitted since the 1970s. The Energy Department has announced $75 million in a new coal export terminal in Oakland, California. The Interior Department has paid energy companies to cancel planned wind farms off the coast of California and other blue states, and the president ordered a company to restart a pipeline that caused one of the state's largest oil spills in 2015. And just last week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration signaled it could curb the power of the California Coastal Commission, a state agency that has protected the shoreline from threats like oil spills for more than half a century. Now, news analysis from Anton Troinovsky from Washington. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent tried to reassure investors worried about the pressure campaign on Iran on Thursday, declaring that a resumption of large-scale fighting was unlikely. The problem for the Trump administration is that Iran was also listening. President Trump this week promised an economic D-Day against Iran, a crushing operation to cripple Iran. The U.S. clampdown is formidable, a combination of wartime destruction, a naval blockade, and sanctions that have already put the Iranian economy under more pressure than its regime has experienced in decades. But between the lines of the administration's threats was the signal that Mr. Bessent made as clear as ever on Thursday. Mr. Trump does not want to go back to war right now. The president is waging an economic campaign against Iran, already having spent weeks bombing the country earlier this year and having stepped back from multiple threats since then to resume the violence. As a result, experts say Mr. Trump is stuck in a conflict with limited leverage, a demonstrated vulnerability, and an emboldened adversary. Even as Iran reels from shortages and inflation, Mr. Trump is likely to increasingly feel the pressure of the approaching midterm election in the shadow of an unpopular war and high gas prices. It is a dangerous combination, experts say, that could prompt Iran to sense America's weakness and lash out. They read him now as not wanting to escalate militarily. Dennis Ross, a former Middle East negotiator for the presidents of both parties, said of Iran's leaders, that creates an incentive for them to show that they may escalate militarily. Mr. Besant told CNBC on Thursday that the Treasury Department would hold a news conference about the new measures targeting Iran next Monday. He said traders had been wrong to bid up the price of oil in response, given that the administration's new economic threats were a sign that there would not be an immediate return to full-scale bombing. A top Iranian official said on Friday that his country would seek to dampen the effect of economic sanctions after the Trump administration vowed to aggressively tighten its pressure campaign against Tehran. We must plan for the unjust sanctions so that we can overcome them, the Iranian official Mohammed Bagar Chalibat, who is the lead negotiator in talks with the United States, told a gathering of Iranian and Iraqi business representatives in Baghdad, according to a post on his social media channel. He did not elaborate on how Iran might circumvent further sanctions after President Trump promised this week to hit the country with an economic D-Day. Yet, as Tehran braces for the potential for more conflict, his comments was one of the most direct acknowledgments from Tehran in recent days that sanctions were hurting and needed to be managed. The United States has already imposed debilitating sanctions on Iran's economy and leadership, and the Trump administration has previously imposed sanctions on foreign businesses and organizations that trade with Tehran. But Washington suggested this week that officials were preparing measures to target countries that buy Iranian oil. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who is expected to detail the new measures at a news conference on Monday, wrote on social media on Thursday evening, any remaining tie to Tehran will hasten a nation's economic oblivion, whether that be the purposely constructed or willfully ignored. From Tel Aviv, a Palestinian teenager was killed on Friday after Israeli settlers entered a village near the West Bank city of Hebron. Local officials said the latest in a surge of violence in the territory that has drawn international condemnation. The rising settler violence against Palestinians in recent weeks comes as they face intensifying pressure on several fronts, including an immense economic squeeze from Israel, as well as mass displacement and settlement encroaching on their land. The Israeli government is now advancing a long-touted plan to build new homes for settlers in a key part of the West Bank, a move condemned this week by European nations, Canada and Australia. On Friday, the Health Ministry of the Palestinian Authority identified the latest victim as 17-year-old Karim Shaldeh, Palestinian and Israeli officials offering different accounts of the events. Now the Budapest Dispatch by Anthony Higgins from Budapest. Ferdinand Marcos, the longtime dictator of the Philippines, suffered the indignity after losing power. So did Viktor Yanukovych, Ukraine's kleptocratic leader, and Nicolae Ceaușescu, Romanian's communist tyrant. All had their private offices, off-limits to all but loyal courtiers, for years suddenly thrown open to the public. Throngs of people clumped through their quarters, marveling in disgust at the over-the-top gold-trimmed decor and extravagant luxury. Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary for 16 years until his humiliating defeat in an April election, was never a despot, but his downfall has still opened his long-sealed inner sanctum to public gaze. For the past 3 months, Mr. Orban's suite of offices in a lavishly renovated 17th-century Carmelite monastery overlooking the Danube River has been crowded with Hungarians eager for a peek inside the rooms from where the country was run. Peter Magyar, Mr. Orban's successor as Prime Minister, started the stampede shortly after he was sworn into office in May. He visited the former monastery known as Carmelita, live-streaming his wanderings through empty corridors of deposed power and declaring them a symbol of the lordliness, opulence and lies of Mr. Orban's rule. As an exercise in political theatre designed to shock, however, the opening up of Carmelita has disappointed some visitors. The building's interior is not particularly opulent and looks more like a high-end boutique hotel than a spendthrift dictator's pleasure dome. Mr. Magyar's telling, Mr. Orban's election defeat was not a routine Democrat transition but a total regime change and was the start of what he calls Operation Cleansing Fire, the exposure and purge of the previous government's wasteful extravagance. Balax Orban, the former Prime Minister's political director, said Mr. Magyar was trying to fuel the fiction. Our liberal political enemies always accused us of being dictators, but we never crossed that line, he said, noting that Mr. Orban accepted his election defeat without complaint and made no attempt to hang on to his office in Carmelita. From Islamabad, Pakistan, Imran Khan, Pakistan's former prime minister, was briefly transferred on Friday to a hospital in Islamabad, the capital, for a medical checkup that doctors and Mr. Khan's sister said had revealed his major health issues. Two leaders of Mr. Khan's party, Arif Alvi and Sukhavar Bukhari, confirmed that he had been moved shortly after midnight. After an examination with a team of doctors that including an ophthalmologist and cardiologist, Mr. Khan was transferred back to prison at around 5 a.m., according to Atullah Taram, Pakistan's information minister. The doctors declared Mr. Khan medically fit, Mr. Taram said, adding that his sister, Dr. Uzma Khan, was present throughout the examination. Pakistan's Supreme Court on Tuesday had ordered that Mr. Khan, 73, be moved to Shifa International Hospital for a complete medical checkup and treatment for an eye ailment. The court also ordered the formation of a medical board to assess his condition that included Mr. Khan's private doctors and his sister and granted his family weekly visitation rights. His relatives would bear the cost of treatment, the court said. But Mr. Taraz said Mr. Khan was taken to a public hospital in Islamabad, the Pakistan Institute of Medical Sciences, because of the presence of Mr. Khan's party members near the Shifa Hospital. In a news conference, Dr. Khan, his sister, accused the government of violating the court order, but also acknowledged that Mr. Khan's health was fine. On September 16, the court is scheduled to resume hearings on various petitions Mr. Khan has made about his medical treatment, conditions in prison and access to doctors and family, as well as a pending challenge related to one of his sentences. Mr. Khan has been in prison since August 2023 and was convicted last year on multiple charges of corruption. The ruling on Mr. Khan's medical care went further than previous court orders, which had only mandated treatment but had not required a move out of the prison, a demand that his family and supporters had been making for months. After 2.5 months abroad, President Paul Biya returned to Cameroon on Thursday, according to state media, as questions mounted about his health and succession plans. Since assuming office in 1982, Mr. Biya has become known for frequent stays overseas, where he has amassed hotel bills that by some estimates have reached into the millions of dollars. The Cameroonian authorities banned public discussions of the strongman's ruler's health in 2024 as speculation surrounding his absences grew. During his latest stint overseas in Switzerland, the president issued official statements but did not appear on camera or clarify the purpose of what his office called a brief private stay. On Thursday, Mr. Biya's plane landed in Yaoundé, the capital, the state broadcaster Cameroon Radio Television reported. Brief footage, which could not be independently verified, showed Mr. Beer shaking hands with officials before stepping into a car. The state broadcaster televised large crowds of people singing and dancing outside the airport, many of them wearing clothes printed with the faces of Mr. Beer and his wife Chantal, who is also an influential public figure. While Mr. Beer was away, Cameroon continued to grapple with armed conflict and political uncertainty. A militant secessionist movement in the English-speaking regions of the country is in its 10th year. Threats also loomed in the far north, where extremists affiliated with the Islamic State attacked villages earlier this year seeking to expand their influence. And more recently, a deadly landslide on Tuesday at a mine in the neighboring Central African Republic killed 100 people, including several Cameroonian miners. Some Cameroonian analysts and journalists have said that the president's most recent trip was among his longest and most troubling. This latest stint weakened the perception of him as a genuine leader attached to his people and his country, said Christopher Mayot, the Director General for Central and West Africa Programs at the National Democrat Institute for International Affairs, a non-profit organization in Washington. From Washington, a luxury jet from Qatar, a pair of leopards from Saudi Arabia, and now the latest foreign gifts to arrive in President Trump's Washington are exquisitely crafted gazebos, courtesy of the President of Uzbekistan. The Uzbek gazebos will be exhibited in West Potomac Park, the site of Mr. Trump's planned National Garden of American Heroes. Trucks carrying huge boxes with postage labels from Tashkent, the Uzbek capital, were spotted there in recent days. Parks in Uzbekistan feature gazebos with intricate traditional Central Asian wood carving. President Shavkat Mirziyoyev of Uzbekistan generously donated the traditional Uzbek gazebos to President Donald J. Trump, who accepted them on behalf of the people of the United States of America, said Katie Martin, the communications director for the Interior Department. Visitors to West Potomac Park will be able to enjoy the exquisitely crafted ones later this fall. Mr. Trump is planning an expansive project in West Potomac Park, an area of mostly sports fields near the National Mall. That would include reflecting pools, dining facilities, and an amphitheater, alongside 250 lifestyle statues of notable Americans. Near the proposed Gardens of Heroes is a golf course that Mr. Trump has proposed making into a luxury destination. But both projects are in the early planning stages, according to the Trump administration officials. Any plans for the Garden of Heroes would typically go through the National Capital Planning Commission and the Commissioner of Fine Arts, including the designs for individual statues. The Justice Department told a federal court this week that the Garden of Heroes remains merely a vision of the president's that is still a preliminary concept. In June, the United States and Uzbekistan accelerated negotiation toward a trade and investment deal. Uzbekistan committed to eliminating or reducing tariffs on a wide range of U.S. industrial goods and agricultural products. The United States committed to providing favorable consideration on tariff actions for Uzbek industrial goods and agricultural products. Last year, the Trump administration and the president announced that they said the $32 billion in bilateral commercial deals. The United States also supports Uzbekistan in its World Trade Organization accession process. Mr. Trump called the president highly respected in a social media post and congratulated him on buying $8 billion worth of Boeing airplanes. For the first time, a Chinese aerospace company landed the bottom part of a rocket that went into space, state media reported on Wednesday, marking an advance for the country in its ability to partly reuse rockets for future missions. The success follows the recovery of a different rocket's booster stage, or first stage, which returned upright to a platform at sea last month. That vehicle was operated by a state-owned corporation, while Tuesday's breakthrough was achieved by a private startup, LandSpace. Reusing rocket boosters would allow Chinese satellite makers to reduce the cost of getting to orbit and better compete in the global space market. China is already prepped and primed to scale different space capabilities like satellite communications, but they just needed reusable launch to really unlock the economics of that. Kathleen Curley, a senior research analyst at Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology, said in an interview on Wednesday, "Now that they've had multiple instances with two separate entities landing reusable rockets," she said, "it just gives them even more power and capability to scale these companies that will be competitors for American companies." China still lags far behind its American competitors, she said, especially SpaceX, the private space juggernaut founded by Elon Musk. It first achieved a booster landing with its Falcon 9 vehicle in 2015. The Falcon 9 now launches and lands reused boosters on an almost daily basis. A second company, Blue Origin, started by the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, landed the booster of its New Glenn rocket for the first time last year. It is part of China's core state strategy to pursue dominance in space, Ms. Curlew said, and Wednesday's launch and booster landing was another step forward towards that goal. From Washington, the State Department on Thursday designated an American scholar arrested in China on spying charges in June as having been wrongfully detained. The detained U.S. citizen, Wu Minxin, disappeared in China's Yunnan province after traveling there to attend an academic conference at the invitation of the Chinese government, according to the State Department. "We call on Beijing to release all U.S. citizens arbitrarily detained or exit banned in China," Dylan Johnson, the Assistant Secretary of State for Global Affairs, wrote on social media. "The safety and security of U.S. citizens in the State Department's top priority." The official designation comes about a month before President Trump is expected to host President Xi Jinping of China for an official visit, following Mr. Trump's trip to Beijing this spring. It also comes as U.S. allies in the Asia-Pacific region have grown increasingly concerned about the United States' willingness to help defend them against China and its partners, after Mr. Trump and the Pentagon recently scaled back major military exercises with South Korea. Mr. Minxin is a political scientist and executive director of a strategy and policy group founded in Myanmar, though its move, its headquarters after a 2021 military coup in that country, formerly known as Burma, the Chinese province where he was detained, borders Myanmar. Mr. Minxin, who was living in Thailand, has written on the politics of Myanmar for the opinion section of the New York Times, among other U.S. news organizations. His arrest took place less than 2 weeks before President Meng Anghan of Myanmar made a 5-day visit to China, and less than 3 weeks after Mr. Trump's state visit to Beijing. Since returning to the Oval Office, Mr. Trump has adopted a warmer stance towards China in pursuit of what Trump and Xi administration officials have labeled constructive strategy stability between the two powerhouses. Mr. Minxin's arrest has complicated that trajectory. He is one of two U.S. citizens in China to have officially declared by the State Department as wrongfully detained. The other, Yulin Chen, a seismologist, was detained at a Beijing airport in 2024 while trying to return to the United States. From Toronto, Canadian and American negotiators restarted intensive talks on Friday in Washington as the deadline to reach a trade deal by midnight neared. Details of the talks, which President Trump had earlier this week hailed as successful and described as a good deal, were unclear, but the discussions were focused on a number of issues that make up the broader mosaic of trade disagreements between the two countries. The talks were precipitated by Mr. Trump's July threat to impose new tariffs on some $20 billion worth of Canadian goods, on top of hefty tariffs already in place on major Canadian industries, such as its steel, lumber, and automobiles. That came against the backdrop of the Trump administration's declining to renew the United States-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement for the long term, forcing it into annual reviews and injecting volatility into the cornerstone of North American trade. The original deadline for the new tariffs, which had been set for earlier this week, but Mr. Trump extended it to midnight Friday, meaning the tariffs would take effect at 12:01 Saturday, citing good progress in negotiations. On the Canadian side, concessions were already taking shape, highlighting the bind Prime Minister Mark Carney is in. On a call with Canadian provincial leaders on Wednesday afternoon, Mr. Carney asked them to restore the sale of U.S. liquor. Most premiers had banned the sale last year in retaliation for U.S. tariffs on key Canadian industries, and the issue had become a sore point for the Trump administration. From London, Prince Harry and six other high-profile figures in Britain were ordered on Friday to make an initial payment of £9.54 million, about $13 million, to the publishers of the Daily Mail after they lost a privacy case against the company. In July, the group of claimants, which included the singer Elton John and the actress Liz Hurley, failed in its efforts to sue the publisher, Associated Newspapers, over allegations of phone hacking and intruding into its members' private lives between 1993 and 2011. On Friday, a judge in the High Court in London ordered them to make an initial payment on account by August 28th for the legal costs incurred by the newspaper company in the case. In a written statement that summarized the ruling, the judge, Sir Matthew Nicholling, said that the reasonable sum on account is £9,544,355. The judge, whose formal title in the High Court is Mr. Justice Nicholling, declined to impose a cap on the total payment that might be ordered from the claimants, meaning they might eventually have to pay up to £34.5 million, the costs the Associated Newspapers said it had incurred up to July this year. However, he said in his full ruling that associated costs appear exceptionally high and largely unexplained, so a court assessment would take place to determine the appropriate final sum. The judge's ruling comes just days after Prince Harry and his wife Meghan made public their plans to return to Britain with their children, Prince Archie 7 and Princess Lilibet 5. The court case against Associated Newspapers was Harry's last in a series he is undertaking against Britain's tabloids, with whom he has had a fractious relationship. The seven claimants ordered to pay the initial multi-million pound fees are Harry, Elton John and his husband David Furnish, Simon Hughes, a former lawmaker, the actresses Sadie Frost and Liz Hurley, and Doreen Lawrence, a member of the House of Lords and social justice campaigner, whose son was the victim of a notorious 1993 racist murder case. The seven claimants had accused private investigations of listening in on phone calls, intercepting voicemail messages, and tricking people into handing over information to obtain phone numbers, medical records, and bills. From Berlin, German security services are investigating a plan to conduct a politically motivated attack, possibly directed by a foreign power, that was linked to guns found stashed in a forest on the edge of Berlin, the interior minister said on Friday. While Alexander Dobrindt, the interior minister, was careful not to point a finger at any nation, the news came amid increasing fear of destabilizing hybrid attacks that European governments have blamed publicly and privately on Russia. This case shows that we are working on the assumption that the risk level is high, Mr. Dobrindt said at a news conference, noting that he had upgraded the threat level this year to high from abstract. The German police are investigating a man who is believed to be a low-level operative involved in hiding the two handguns and ammunition found near Berlin. The man, whose name and nationality have not been made public, is in a Romanian jail in connection with a separate matter. The authorities did not release details about the alleged plot, but Germany's federal prosecutor who was overseeing the case is investigating the man for possible foreign agent activity and the preparation of a serious crime endangering the state, both criminal offences that carry significant prison time if he is charged and convicted. Peter Newman, a professor of security studies at King's College London, said that if the evidence showed the Kremlin was responsible, the German government would face a difficult balance over what to say publicly and what to take in response. From Johannesburg, political turmoil is growing in Zambia after the arrest of dozens of opposition politicians, the fatal shooting of a former government minister, and news reports suggesting that President Hakainde Hichilema benefited from the fraud in the recent presidential election. The tumult in the wake of his re-election last week has cast a cloud over his victory. While he was first elected 5 years ago, he was lauded as a champion of democracy in Africa. International observers and human rights activists accused the incumbent he defeated, Edgar Lungu, of using violence and repression to maintain power. Mr. Hichilema himself has been a political prisoner. Now some of those same observers have accused him and his party of using government resources to manipulate voter support and suppress opposition. The European Union said its observer mission found serious indictments and procedural irregularities during the counting and tabulation of the election last week. Zambian activists, the United Nations and Amnesty International have sounded alarms over the arrest of opposition politicians over the last week. The UN human rights chief has urged Zambian authorities to stop arresting people arbitrarily. From Kabul, India, evidence of the artificial intelligence boom often looks like the squat, windowless data centers that house acre after acre of hardware. But near the southern tip of India, the city of Karur is teeming with signs of AR's ascendancy in human form. Hundreds of tech lab workers clog the streets on coffee breaks late on any given weekday afternoon, men and women in their 20s, corporate ID cards dangling from lanyards around their necks. Others work a few hours a weekend from home, supplementing their income by strapping iPhones to their heads and pressing record where they chop vegetables to make or make the bed. They work in a fast-growing field of AI called data annotation, which for the moment at least requires a human touch. As a sentient backlog for artificial intelligence, data annotators help fix bugs and find blind spots in AI models, improving and refining the programs that steer your car, automate an assembly line, and track inventory in retail stores. The work can be rote and less complex than what engineers train for in college, requiring hours in front of a screen to examine video frame by frame. But as AI capabilities change how companies design and produce products, making jobs like coding disappear for college graduates, data annotation is showing how countries like India, with entry-level job shortages and large youth population, are adapting. 3 hours after polls closed on Tuesday night, Florida had reported enough balance for the Associated Press to make calls on almost all of its dozens of contested primary elections. The same night in California, the last votes were cast for a special congressional election to replace former Representative Eric Swalwell. The nail-biter contest between two Democrats was not called until Thursday evening, with a margin of roughly 6,000 votes separating the contenders. California's more sluggish ballot-counting process, which can sometimes delay results for weeks after Election Day, has provided fertile ground for President Trump and his supporters to sow doubt after election results that favor Democrats. This week, though, the counting pace raised another question. Why is Florida that's much faster than California at returning election results? The answer harks back to 2000, when the protracted recount in Florida kept the country in the dark for weeks about the result of the contest between George W. Bush and Al Gore. The delayed results placed the state in a harsh national spotlight and prompted state officials to examine what went wrong. Cord Byrd, the current Florida Secretary of State, said that one major issue at that time was the lack of statewide standards for handling ballots. "We've been hammering away at this for 26 years to craft a well-functioning election code," Mr. Byrd told the New York Times on Thursday. He attributed his state's speed in part to the fact that mail-in ballots must arrive by the time the polls close. "Roughly one-third of Floridians vote by mail," he said. And the Supreme Court on Friday allowed President Trump to continue construction of a White House ballroom to replace the East Wing he demolished last fall. In a one-sentence order, Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., acting on his own, issued a placeholder that gives all nine justices additional time for more fully consider whether construction of the planned 90,000-square-foot ballroom can proceed. The Chief Justice's order did not provide a timeline for when the court would act next, stating only that a lower court ruling against the Trump administration was paused pending further order of the undersigned or of the court. And that's all for today's New York Times. This is Jackie Keith. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you again next week.